But yeah, so let's talk about MS Loot.
My name is Eli, and together with my co-host Boss, we discuss life, the universe, and the ocean.
Oh my god, MS Loot. That was an interesting take. So, the first thing I heard from MS Loot was people complaining that they were basically copying Notion. And that was like just before it started hitting my email and other stuff, because it's this kind of stuff doesn't stay out of the feeds for long. And then I saw the actual image. I think, yeah, on first glance, that does look the same. But at the same time, was going at it like there's so many elements in that you just need to have to be a web application, that when you really boil down to it, like the only thing that I saw that was really, really Notion was the cover image with icon over it on the left side.
Yeah, and I don't doubt that that was on purpose. I don't doubt that they designed that to look somewhat like Notion on purpose. But yeah, that is almost where the similarities end. That and a basis of nonlinear data management, and that things can exist in multiple places at once, is definitely a similarity. But that's also just the future of computing as a whole, and everything's going to go that direction. So to equate it to Notion directly is, yeah, I definitely felt a bit disingenuous.
Yeah, that was like the thing. Like Notion, of course, uses a lot of elements and ideas. And there was also a lot of elements from what I saw in the MS Loop video where I'm going like, this is not Notion. I didn't see them create databases, for example. It's mostly a way to drag in things from other Microsoft solutions. So it wants you to drag in stuff from PowerPoint and Word and Excel and stuff like that. And I don't think so much that it wants to be a all-in access, Microsoft Access replacement like Notion is, where you can just build your own solutions and templates in it and then use that as your single source of truth. Well, I think with Microsoft, they want their single source of truth to be Office files, I think, or maybe a more professional approach. But then you're getting into enterprise-level solutions that take a lot of money and a lot of consultants to get set up.
Yeah, so a couple things there. I definitely feel that it's very, very enterprise focused or in small team focused, especially. And I wouldn't be surprised that it doesn't have a consumer end release, and that it is only with like enterprise 365 stuff. And furthermore, it does seem to be kind of a central hub for content from other Microsoft products. It seems to be more focused on collaboration and brainstorming in meetings and that sort of thing, as opposed to like dashboard creation and no code app kind of creation, which is definitely what Notion is focused on, is creating tools with it.
Yeah, that's like an interesting point on the, what if they really aim this at the enterprise, right? I have MS Teams in groups and stuff, and that's mostly enterprise only. So this could be the same. And by this whole fostering working together is, of course, a place where Microsoft has been behind, because Google Docs basically showed how online collaboration is done. I've seen Miro, which I love for its whiteboard and working together and seeing each other's mouse functionality. So Microsoft seems to be playing a bit of a catch-up set there, because they, of course, want people to work together fully in their ecosystem. They were definitely trying to hammer down on it integrating with MS Teams, which I find a wonderful video call tool and a dreadful chat application. So the integration part seems to be like a strong thing. And I'm also very curious, as a result from that, if it's meant as a SharePoint replacement, because SharePoint hasn't been getting any love for a long time, at least not from what I could see when I was using it. And this feels a bit like, hey, we didn't spend time in SharePoint because we were busy building MS Loop.
Yeah, that would make sense. It also seems to be somewhat a replacement for Microsoft Lists, or at least there's a lot of overlap. And it's interesting because Lisp was made pretty recently and didn't ever really take off. Just kind of interesting. I mean, it's there essentially like ClickUp clone. You know?
I'm doing a quick Google for that because I don't know Microsoft Lists.
Right, you haven't even heard of it.
Yeah, right. And now that I see it, it's like, oh yeah, I've seen screenshots of this, but I haven't digged into it.
Right. So I wonder if they were kind of in the process of creating that and then decided to make it something else. And we'll see if Lists even continues to be. But yeah, I definitely think integration is a big aspect of Microsoft Loop with their other products. And I don't think using it without their other products in the ecosystem is going to be something you can even do to any significant degree.
No. And looking at Lists, I get the feeling that Lists might be something which is integrated into Microsoft Loop. So either it's a evolution of that tool or it's something that is more of like a symbiote with it. They want it to work together. I would be surprised if they didn't do that, because why would you spend energy on two places as a company when you know that both products are in the pipe?
Right. Although in a company that large, it's not entirely out of the question that there could be conflicting development going on.
Yeah, for sure. That always happens, of course. I mean, I just upgraded to Windows 11 only to find out that you can't move the taskbar to the left and the right. And that was one of those things where, yeah, you guys are releasing a product, but not every team was ready yet.
Though that'll always be the case when things change. There seems to be this general consensus about software and games and just about anything really, that the idea is that everyone wants it to be better without changing. And so you can't please everyone no matter what you do. But I mean, that particular one, the taskbar not moving, definitely seems like a big omission.
Yeah, like it's I can live with it. I just switched it to hide. But for someone like me who has like an ultra wide screen, it takes up a lot of real estate, just ridiculous amounts if I would keep it on all the time.
Yeah, I actually use an ultra wide as well. And I don't have much problem keeping it on, but I've always used the bottom taskbar.
Okay.
And also resolution will make a difference. I don't know what resolution your screen is, but at 1440p, it's not too obtrusive. I do wish they still gave you the option to make it smaller, though. That's another
emission. Yeah, that would have been nice, because yeah, I got 1440p height and you know I could have left it on, but I'll just quickly get annoyed because I'm not used to having it there. And then 90% of my use cases is keyboard anyway, so I don't really need the taskbar. I use virtual desktops and Windows type name of tool and RAM the enter button to start things.
100% Windows key, first three letters does the job. I almost never actually click my taskbar.
That's the whole idea of clicking a taskbar. The only thing that's annoying for me right now is I'm very used to having the system tray on the left button and it's now on the right button. But, you know, I can live with that. It's not the end of the world.
Wait, so the system tray opens with the Windows key on the right? Is that what you're saying?
No, the system tray is like if I want a calendar or something, I usually click on the time. And that used to be left button because I had like the bar on the left. And now it's on the right button because the bar is on the bottom, which is a minor change in location. And I'm getting used to it pretty quickly. But it was annoying like the first couple of hours because I was constantly throwing my mouse in the wrong corner to check time or pick a calendar.
Right. I mean, that seems to be the common reaction when things change is people aren't used to something and that makes them upset. And then when they get used to it, it's not a problem anymore. So especially when it comes to muscle memory things, because it can be hard habits to change sometimes. But ultimately, it is just a matter of muscle memory. I see a lot of people complain about things when it's clearly something they're just going to get used to. And it's once they do, it's not actually going to affect their workflow significantly.
Yeah, the muscle memory thing is definitely something that takes a lot of your productivity, depending on how big and how often you use it. So for me, when I, if a software program changes, I need to think about it and decide like, okay, can I live with these changes? Can I rework or relearn these changes? And a simple example I have of that was recently, and I'm currently making a video on that, Todoist added proper keyboard shortcuts, meaning that you can actually use your arrow keys and your I'm not sure what's it in English, like the JK buttons to move up and down to select a task.
Right. Vim bindings.
Do actions. Yeah. Vim binding, stuff like that, which is amazing because they didn't have that for a long while. But I've been using Todoist Shortcuts, which is an extension for this. And they have something where I can type two letters to move tasks, which I use all the freaking time. Like I select a task and I do TC, and that means that I want to change the due date and I want to move it to tomorrow. And then I think W for next week, and there's another one for like clear it, I think R. But that two letter combination is something I use so often that I switched it off and I thought like, I'm going to use the keyboard commands from Todoist and see if those are good enough. And I just couldn't. It was like, this is like too impacting on my workflow, because the Todoist method is that I press the same button, which is good, and then it opens the screen. But then if I want to move it somewhere, I have to press tab, find the right option, and press enter. So it goes from something which was nearly instantaneous, just clicking two buttons on a keyboard, to something where I have to focus on the actual screen because I have to tab through it and find the right option. And that, I think I tried that one for half an hour and said like, no, this just takes too much time. So there's always this balance that I try to find between, okay, I just need to learn these new keyboard commands, which is okay. And oh my God, this just changes my workflow and blocks me and is costing me time every moment of the day times X. Like if it's something you do once a day, it doesn't matter that much. It's something you do every day for 100 times. Then a really small change has a huge impact.
Yeah, absolutely. I do wish there was a greater standardization of shortcuts. I mean, there is to some extent, but it's somewhat loose. I use both Mac and Windows, and whichever one I used last is the muscle memory. So when I switch to the other, like whichever's the function key, the equivalent of control on Windows, just gets me all mixed up every single time I switch back and forth. And it actually lends me to not using both, because it is so much friction when I do switch back and forth. But I do think keyboard shortcuts are almost mandatory and is something I do hope to see Notion do a bit more in, because where they're at now is a bit clunky.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it helps a lot that when I'm typing in Notion, I can do a lot of things by just typing markdown. So like the headings by just typing a couple of the squares. I'm not sure. My English is pretty good. But then when I need to talk symbols that I type on a keyboard, I just fumble because I never have to say those things.
Right. The square brackets.
Yeah, square brackets. So that's already like better than when I'm, for example, using Google Docs, where I need to memorize a keyboard combination to make headers. I'm so used that I can just use the square brackets or the headers or type it, or just now the dash is pretty universal now. Like if I put a dash somewhere, it will make a list in nearly any application. But the heading ones, you know, that's still different. The square brackets is pretty universal.
Just a correction. So the square brackets, I think you're actually talking about the pound sign, hashtag symbol.
Yeah, the pound sign is for the headings, and the square brackets is usually for linking. And the square brackets are pretty universal, but that's mostly because of its keyboard location. I happened to talk to someone, I think they had like it was Tom Solid that said like the German keyboard by default doesn't have the square brackets in a dedicated position. So it's actually like, I think above the 8 and the 9 or something. So he was like, why are all these apps using the square bracket? Because I have to press shift and then like make this weird combination. Right up to the moment that he saw a US keyboard and was like, oh, this is why they're all using it, because it's a fixed button.
That's interesting. I kind of figured a lot of the symbolic stuff was similar across different keyboard layouts and that letters were the primary difference. But that's interesting to know.
Yeah. And then you start realizing that a lot of software is based around the US keyboard. And also one of the main reasons why when I configure my keyboard on any PC, even though I'm Dutch and there is a Dutch layout, I would never use Dutch layout because it would just ruin any type of thought process that went into like 90% of the applications that I use.
Right. I do wonder what the Indian layout is, because obviously most stuff is catered to the US layout because it's developed in the US, but India being, you know, the next largest software developing a country, I wonder what their layout is and if it's similar. I would imagine it probably is. I'm looking at it now, actually.
I'm curious.
Yep, it's pretty similar to US layout, it looks like.
Yeah, I think mostly the symbols are the ones that are interesting, if those are different or not.
I have always, I should look more into international keyboard layouts because I've always kind of wondered how they work, especially with, you know, different length alphabets or with non-Latin based alphabets like Eastern Asian countries. I know they've kind of just adopted English alphabet to a big degree and just adapted it to their language, but they still have to be able to type. And yeah, I actually don't know how like Japanese would do that because they have so many characters in their, it's not really an alphabet, I suppose, but yeah, in their written language, there's so many symbols.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember because I had a Chinese girlfriend once, and when I saw her typing on a keyboard in Chinese, it was like magic. Yeah. And I believe what they use on software keyboards is that there's like a subset. So you basically have like 9 buttons and you press those and you get like 9 different keys and you press those and then you get like another set.
Right, just a lot of modifier keys.
Yeah, so you get into layers, and then with keyboards, yeah, it's a lot of modifier keys, or I think it's a combination of letters that gets transformed into. So you type like the Arabic letters and that those turn into a symbol. But of course, that's like far from ideal. I mean, then you're doing like two transformations in your head, which wouldn't really work.
Right, and I'm sure like phonetic translation into symbology doesn't always work as expected to. Yeah, that's interesting.
I'm just going to have like a quick look at a Chinese keyboard, and there's some really amazing setups. I found like a picture of like a round keyboard, so it's like a huge disc with all these letters on it.
Yeah.
But it seems, yeah, that most of them are regular keyboards with a lot of modifier keys to get it working.
Right. Oh, yeah, I see that circle one. That's pretty wild.
Yeah, that one's amazing. I mean,
that seems more like a novelty than a actual usable or purchasable product. Oh, boy. Oh, that's maybe we'll have to link to this one in the show notes because this is wild.
Yeah, this is wild. I think just Googling like, for Chinese
there's
keyboard,
like six of them.
What,
you
six?
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, and two pedals. And drumsticks? I'm really baffled. One sec. It is in Zencastr chat.
Oh my goodness. Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, that looks like a drum set.
Yeah. Yeah, they have it set up like a drum set, but it's keyboards. Anyway, that's interesting.
All the specific use case, like it looks amazing though. I mean, like I'm not dunking on it. I mean, yeah, it might be a bit impractical if you need to bring that along on your laptop, but
no doubt.
If you need to write a lot of Chinese letters, that seems like the quickest way to just ram at it. I would assume also that the most used symbols are probably in the mid keyboard, and then the rest is like less frequently used ones.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one thing that's kind of come up a lot with that. I see a video of that in use.
Yeah, like if that exists and there's someone that needs it for work, then they must be blinding fast at it.
Yeah, I don't see that anywhere else, I have a feeling it's any sort of standard as far as like a bunch of them in an array like that. But yeah, on the topic of keyboard shortcuts and Microsoft Loop, I've seen a lot of talk about like say Google Docs adding the @mention command to insert things into the document, and people equating that to Notion. And it's mm-hmm. it's just kind of a rumor I've been trying to dispel, or a misunderstanding I've been trying to dispel, because the slash command in Notion, where you hit slash and you have all of your commands there, dates back to the days of DOS in your command line. And so the idea of a single key followed by some letters to do a command is very much not new and very much not unique to Notion.
No, that's definitely as old as time. So you can't really point to Notion and say, like, you know, that's what they invented, because they didn't. They also picked conventions, which is good, because I like conventions, because it means that if I switch apps, they work the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, just moving things around because you want to be different is not good practice.
Yeah. And I think it's worth mentioning with Notion that if you make any comparison to Notion as if Notion was the original creator of something, it's likely wrong, as Notion is kind of the amalgamation of a lot of different ideas, a lot of very old ideas even. And it's interesting because it's something they're very public about. They're very transparent and open about where the ideas for their software came from. I mean, they have a whole blog almost dedicated to it, you know, with their podcast and their blog. But nothing in Notion is unique to Notion. The only thing that's very unique about Notion is putting these things together into one unified system. But yeah, so it's just interesting partially. to compare anything to Notion is to compare it to kind of foundational aspects of computing.
Yeah, true. I think that the one thing that Notion does, which makes it popular and which I still think is absolutely amazing, is that they say no. Basically, they think about what they're going to add to Notion, and they are very reluctant, one would almost say, in adding features to avoid it being this bloated piece of software, which is something that I see in a lot of other solutions and something that I admire. I mean, if I look at something like Coda, which I use a lot, that one has everything that you can possibly imagine, but it also makes it super hard to learn, and that means that there's like packs and things that you need to add and things that you need to attach and theory that you need to get. And then I get to something like Notion and people just type away, and then at some point, oh, I can make a table, that's interesting. That I think is the core strength of Notion, to keep it simple, which is one of the hardest thing to do, and something where another big company like Apple is known for, like, you know, subtract until you're back to like the main core reason why you build something.
Yeah, the COO talked about that, in that their onboarding experience is very, very intentionally made to be as accessible as possible, but as deep as possible for those who want it, which is, I'm sure, a difficult balance to strike. But I think a big part of what gets them there is that they're addition of features always seems to be about covering as many bases with a single thing as possible. So things can be used in many different ways and open up possibilities to many different things, even though the core functionality of that particular feature is simple. One thing that comes to mind is sync blocks. The amount of possibilities you could do with sync blocks is pretty astounding, but the fundamental idea of it is very simple, which is just a block existing in two places at once. So I think they do that a lot with trying to cover a lot of things. And I think it's why recurring tasks hasn't happened, because it's something that's going to be accomplished with a bigger overarching feature. And in that case, probably some type of automation.
Yeah, which is one of the coolest and scariest things to add for someone like Notion, because cool because you could suddenly do so much more. And it's scary because there's a good chance that it becomes too complicated. Like, how do you simplify something which is fundamentally complex, teaching a computer to act the way you want it to act?
Right. I think the answer actually lies in how they teach the rest of it and how they make the rest of it accessible, and is namely templates. I think they'll be automation templates. You know, like, you want a reoccurring task, it's just a template you apply, and then opening that up to the community to create their own templates for automation just creates that easy entry point for people who don't want to get into the weeds.
Yeah, but then I need to solve another problem, which is one of my pet peeves with the no code stuff in general. And that is, how do you upgrade templates? Because now it's like you modify the templates that you get almost immediately, so you can't really upgrade templates. Mm-hmm. But once you start adding automation in it, which basically makes it more complex code-like, at some point you might get like, hey, I've built like version 2 of this template, and you want some way to upgrade the logic that's in your set without changing the data that you already added. And then we're getting like looping back to how code is written and upgrade paths. And then it suddenly becomes very complex. So you want a balance there that people can use stuff others build, but then also update it, because else you have to like copy and paste commands over. And that's exactly what you were trying to avoid.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. I think it's actually probably one of their biggest obstacles, because very obviously, tool makers is a huge part of the future of Notion, and allowing those tool makers to create tools that can change over time and be updated is going to be essential, I think. And yeah, I don't know how to solve that. I have very few ideas on how to solve that in a way that's accessible, you know, because you have versioning with Git, and you know, there's obviously established ways of doing these things, but how to make that friendly to the user end and functional across anything someone could make with it is, yeah, that's a huge obstacle.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that, and I think that the main way to solve it is by a separation between data and display. Meaning that if you would use a template with a lot of code in it, you would be able to say like, on this page is where I want to keep the data. And then that page has sub-tables, right, with the data in it. And the rest is all linked to those tables. So, and then you would need an interface to keep it that way. Now my tinkering side would say like, hey, I want to be able to just go through this template and then hook up everything that needs data to my own tables that I already got. But my usability side would say like, no, just hook it up to like one data page so that you can say like, hey, I've got an upgrade for this template, get template, select my data page, and then it keeps working. And then all the smart stuff is in the template, because that one knows like, okay, on that page there's tables, they're called A, B, and C, and they've got columns with like a name and a name B and a name C. And as long as I can find those, then I can use them. And if I can't find them, then they're just get created and they're empty. Something like that would, right, I think, be the...
So essentially making it static for the user of that template.
Yeah. The template itself is static. Like if you modify the template to suit your needs or something, then you immediately break like your upgrade capabilities as well, right? Because then you have to keep track of like all the changes, and then we get like into things within Git sound like merging code. That becomes way too complex. But if you would say like, hey, you can like use this template, and if you don't change anything, you can upgrade, unless you make a change, that means that you effectively made a fork. I think that would help a lot of people. And I also think that would grow a new marketplace, because right now templates are interesting, but at the same time, they're also pretty basic. I mean, there's usually like a structure or something there to get you started, but you don't really get like a template to solve all your problems. While I would think that once you get into automation and a more fine-tuned way of displaying information, and you will be able to separate it so you can get like newer updated versions with new functionality in it, that's a totally different ballgame. I mean, it's not even templates anymore. It sounds more like plugins then.
Right. Yeah. It's an interesting thing, because I mean, even as someone who makes templates, I would not suggest to users of Notion to use templates. I would definitely suggest they build it, because of some of those limitations, and because of just being able to understand how it works is important when you can change anything. Because if you mess something up, you need to know how it works to fix it. But yeah, static would fix that. But it also leaves the question of, is that part of the value system of Notion, you know, to do that?
Could be. I think there's like two use cases here. we have the tinkerers, the ones that want to shape Notion to be the way they want it to be. And then you have the more end users, so the ones that said like, hey, I would like a solution that I would be able to use. And those two communities are both part of the Notion set. There's a set that would use a template and then make maybe some slight modifications, but probably not much, just use it as is. And I can't imagine using Notion like that, because for me, 9 out of 10 times is quicker to build it, because I just know Notion so well. And I think like yesterday I was making a project for like a new holiday trip I'm going on. And I was like halfway filling the page going like, wait a minute, I built a template. I made a video about a holiday template. Why am I not using my own templates here? So I went back and got my template. And I was like, oh yeah, I had some good ideas in this. But it's just so easy to make stuff in Notion that I actually started using less templates over time because I just feel more.
Yeah, it's interesting. I made a task and project management system that's like very, very in-depth based on a lot of like different self-development ideas, very structured. And I think it's really excellent, and I don't use it because it's I need the flexibility.
Yeah, I got the same one. I have like a system that I built, and I use the ideas from that system, but I don't use the specific template itself anymore. And I think that the main reason is because I'm always building the next version of that template. So even if I use the template, it just gets changed over time. And then at some point I'm going like, okay, I need to make this accessible for other people. And that means that I just go through it and cut out everything that's just not necessarily or not needed to make it simple. And then I package that with like a lot of help in it to help people get started. Mm-hmm. But I still notice that the more simple templates that I make are much more popular because people can read that and then use it as a stepping stone to build their own tools, which I think is a much more popular option in Notion than just using things as is.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually don't know of anyone that just uses someone else's template as is. Then again, most of the people I know are creators in the community and not so much just users. Which is just, it's kind of interesting though, that, I mean, that separation definitely exists already, you know, between the tool makers and the tool users, but the platform itself definitely encourages being a tool maker.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed that bit more with Coda, because they actually have like the different privileges, right? Doc maker and editor. And Coda, I'm using that in like a larger organization, and there you meet both ends. You meet the people that said, I just want it to work, and you meet the people that go like, no, I want to upgrade a bit. I want to know a bit more so that I can tweak this and do not have to ask somebody else to fix it for me. And there, because Coda is more complex than Notion, you see more users. I think Notion simplicity is what makes that people just go like, I can just tinker with it a bit because I'll just add a field here and I'll just modify it a bit there. And I'll make it more personal. It's also one of the weak points when you start working in a group, because the logic for most Notion templates and pages is in your head and not in the page.
Right. Yeah. The processes need to be spelled out in group settings. And because of that, they're a little more concrete or a little harder to change.
Yeah, definitely harder to change, because even if you make a system near perfect, you write down like how they need to use the system and stuff like that. Once you get it into people's heads and you want to change the system, it doesn't work because they're not no longer reading the instructions. They just know how they develop the workflow.
And right. You just stop the taskbar from going to the left side of the screen.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah. Yep. And can affect their muscle memory.
That's just true. This is why when I write procedures for companies, like internal procedures, I always write two sets of documents. So there's the checklist, which is the stuff that you just need to go through and just check mark it, like I did X, and the instructions. And then the instructions usually have multi layers to it. So I have like an overview that's just like do this, 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 and this. And then they link to like a detailed document that tells you exactly how to do set thing, so that if you don't know, you can just click on it and figure it out. But the checklist is nearly essential because that's the place where I can mark down changes. So if I change a process, then I can, so like I use the new process for sub step X or something and just chuck it in the checklist. for a while, like say a month or so. And then because the people that work with it are required to do the checklist, else they can't close. That means that they have to read the changes. So like I can add a check to that, say like, did you notice that we changed this? And after a month, you can remove that because everybody's updated. But right. It's a way like programming people.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's a huge part of your job is just programming people.
It is
just as much as it is making the system.
It's the one thing that like when you write systems or you try to improve something, you want it written down, and there's this very cruel balance there. And I think it's the same when you're writing something like a Notion system, is you don't want to add everything, and most of the times in removing stuff, because if you don't clean up your documentation or processes, it just keeps growing and growing and growing until you get to a point that nobody reads it.
Yeah, any system needs entropy prevention.
Yeah,
because all systems decay over time. Yeah,
they do, and it's a hard, like I use the term bit rot very often, and I sometimes get people that look at me weird, like how does something which is digital decay? And I said it does. Just trust me on this one. It's digital; it decays.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, a foundational principle of all existence is entropy. Yeah. But do you actually do Notion systems for clients very much?
No, because the clients that I work for are usually large corporations, so the Dutch government, stuff like that, and they are not allowed to use Notion for any professional stuff because they don't. Notion doesn't yet get all the GDPR rules that's part of European law. This is also why I was almost shouting when I heard that they were opening an office in Dublin, because that meant that they were getting an office in Europe. And that means that they can actually get those certifications for the GDPR, meaning I could be able to use it at work finally.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure that's a priority considering the majority of their revenue comes enterprise.
Yeah, like enterprise, the big one. It's also one of the things that I complained about. Well, I wouldn't say complain, but remarked and said, like, if you want the European businesses, you need to follow a certain set of laws. And one of those requires that you have a company inside Europe. And that's like mandatory because, you know, data and stuff. It's one of those weird things where I see people use Notion, but they can't put anything sensitive in it. So it's a bit half Notion.
Yeah, I don't have much concern personally or for my business, but it is also a small business. And obviously, there's certain things I won't store in Notion, like customers' credit cards and things like that. But do you know if part of the government requirement there would be end-to-end?
The part of the government requirement is that it's in a European data center and it's encrypted at rest. Those are the basics.
That's not too bad, because Notion satisfies that then.
Yeah.
Well, at least the data at rest.
Yeah, the data at rest bit they do. And the moving it to a European data center is also not that hard because they use Amazon as a backend. Mm-hmm. So they can just set up a cluster and say, like, this cluster needs to be in one of the Amazon's European data centers, and then they're done. So, I'm oversimplifying because there's a lot of rules that you need to go through, like spreadsheets of things that you need to check off. Yeah. But the large stack, like having the data in Europe and having it encrypted, are the biggies, the ones that I worry about the most. But it's one of the reasons why I started using things like Obsidian and Logseq at some point, because those things encrypt locally and then send the encrypted file up the line. And that just gives me a lot of comfort sleeping well, because I know it is stored in the cloud somewhere, but it's encrypted by a password that only I know. Well, technically LastPass knows it, but they also encrypt everything in the cloud, and that's encrypted with another password that I know. So it's a bit turtles all the way down.
I think I may be kind of particular in this sense, but I don't have a need for my digital information. Like, I could lose everything tomorrow and go about my life relatively normal. A bit bummed out, but relatively normal. There's just nothing that important at the end of the day. I mean, like, losing all my tax information would be, you know, a pain in the butt or in things like that. But there's nothing that would actually significantly impact my life if I just lost everything tomorrow. And so I've never been very concerned with like a data redundancy. and things like that, because it's just not the biggest deal if I lose it. Granted, I still practice data redundancy and stuff, but I feel like it's overblown by a lot of people, or a lot of people may think it's more important than it is to some degree.
There's a bit of a yes, no, but that's because I had a lot of family members that came to my house crying because they lost all their family pictures.
I mean, see, and I'm the type of person who will multiple times have just gotten rid of stuff because I don't need it anymore. I don't care. I'm not super sentimental, so that definitely plays into it. But yeah, I don't have much dating back very far, whether it be photos or even physical possessions. It just doesn't feel super important to me, but I do acknowledge that I'm kind of strange in that way.
There's like different types of data. I could lose a lot of data and not care, which is good because we're more than just our data. There's also a lot of data that falls in the category of, if I lose it, it's mostly a pain to recover because it's information that I would have to call companies and get back, or as you said, taxes, which is something that, oh my God, that would be so many calls. That would definitely impact my life badly, mostly because I hate calling these companies and jumping through hoops. And then there's a couple of notes that I'm processing right now that I'm going like, oh yeah, then that would be nice if I didn't lose those, but I can recover from that. And then again, any data we look at some point in time, we will cease to be on this planet, and then that data becomes technically worthless anyway.
Right. There's almost no greater comfort than the knowing that all of this is going to end. A bit existential, but it's something I actually think about relatively often in my decisions and how I think about life. Just really like what actually matters, you know? Yeah. At the end of the day, it seems like, the only things that truly matter are the joy you bring to yourself and other people.
Yeah, this is very much true. As a person that sees a lot of people that are currently in panic because of the whole pandemic bit, for example, really up in arms sometimes about it, is this really your most important thing? Yes, it's annoying and things aren't around it, but are you currently healthy? Do you have family around you, people you care about? Those things, in the grand scheme of thing, are more important. And I actually have a list in front of me that's on a whiteboard. And that's my priority list in life. And my priority list in life goes girlfriend, son, YouTube, and then work. And that's the list. That's
oof to
anything
the sun.
Else.
I guess it's not in any particular order.
Hmm?
I just said oof for the sun being second, but I guess it's probably not in any particular order.
Well, actually, the number one there is me, because
right.
And a lot of parents hated me for that one, but I always said the first person you should take care of is yourself, because if you don't take care of yourself, at some point you either break or you become a very annoying person and nobody likes that. Mm-hmm. And then the second person is your partner, because if you don't take care of your partner, you're supposed to tackle this world together. And if you let that go, then at some point you get into fights, and that will greatly affect the life of your children. And then come the children. And that doesn't mean that, of course, depending on the situation, priorities don't shift. But keeping those things in mind, it trickles down, basically. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people forget. They spend all their time on the children, and suddenly they are depressed and their marriage is broken. And then the children are unhappy as well. So
yeah,
this
I mean,
is
that's
why
exceedingly, exceedingly common.
Yeah. So that's why I'm saying children are the third thing on the list. I mean, it doesn't mean you have to be a dick about it, but it does mean that if you're having a bad day, or you need some rest, or you need to, I don't know, walk in a forest, ask. And I've made the same mistake in my life. At one point I was sitting in a ski lift for an indoor ski paradise, and I was crying. And the reason I was crying, because I hadn't used my snowboard for 5 years, because I put my children and my relationship first, and I didn't think of myself. And at that point, when I was sitting in the lift, I realized hey, that wasn't healthy. I should have at least kept a few of the hobbies or a few of the things that I found important for my own enjoyment and my own mental well-being. And that's why I'm very stiffler on that order these days. It's a personal experience in it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely believe in positive selfishness, if you will. I think people don't want to be selfish because of the connotation, even though the better you are, the better you can be for everything else. Yeah. But I think it gets conflated with greed, you know, it gets conflated with, I don't know how to put it. Yeah. Self-servingness, you know, because you could be selfish at the service of others. And that's kind of a weird contradictory sounding statement, but.
Yeah. But a bit of selfishness is important. It doesn't mean, I think that it becomes selfish when you don't take others into account. Like, man, I really need to sit down and play a video game is taking care of myself. But if my son comes to me and says, like, I'm not feeling well, then I'll postpone the game to go to the doctors, right? So that's like an obvious example where you take care of yourself. You know that you want to do that, but you also know, like, I need to shift priorities. The only problem comes if you don't take care of yourself for a long period. So if you find out that you haven't been playing video games for like a month while you really need something like that, because all the other things go first, like there's nothing wrong with at some point going like, you know, daddy needs his me time. I'm going to spend an evening playing video games and asking your partner, a friend, someone else to look after the kids. You know, it's, and that balance is tricky.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people deal with guilt when it comes to serving themselves before someone else, which is understandable, but maybe misplaced a lot of times.
Yeah, yeah, because it's a balance, right? It's when they talk about work-life balance, which I don't believe in, by the way, because work would like to see it balanced towards them all the time. But when we talk about life balance, you have to like weigh things. And I can't really balance on priority because that stuff just happens. But you can balance on time and see when it's skewed, right? So, for example, one of the things that I usually recommend to friends that became parents is like, you know, get a sitter and take one evening in the week to get a sitter, watch the kids and go out together, you know, be adults. Because I remember when my kid was small and at some point you're just dying to talk to an adult, right?
Right. Sorry, my cat's running around. One second.
Yeah.
All right. She's got the zoomies.
Ah, yeah, that happens here once in a while as well. And then it's like, the house is too small. Doesn't matter how big the house is.
Yeah. But so, yeah, on the topic of like putting yourself first, me and my girlfriend definitely have what some people would call like an interesting or non-traditional setup. I mean, so we sleep in separate beds. We have separate rooms and it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things that it seems like most people struggle with sleep with their partner. So it's like, why are you committed to that? Why is that important? Yeah, I never could really come up with a reason of why that would really matter when there's so much benefit of putting yourself first in that way. Like we would never go back to sleeping in the same bed unless it was extra large king. And even then we have different schedules a lot of the time, even if it's by an hour, you know, and it just makes sense. And I think thinking about things without preconceived notions of how they should be is really.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one. And because there's like, I mean, I love sleeping next to my partner, my current partner, but I also had relationships where it just didn't work. And sleep is so important. So at some point you have to go like, you know, sure, this is expected, but we're a much better fit if we get a proper night's sleep. And, you know, then you have to like find a way around it. And sleeping like with some distance, I used to have like two different blankets, for example, that already helped a lot. There was no fighting over the blankets in night. And small things like that, they don't sound big until you're slightly sleep deprived over a longer piece of time. And then at some point you want to kill each other, not because you hate each other, but because lack of sleep.
Right. Well, and just little things add up. It can add up to resentment, or at least like play a role in that, you know? So if there's a disagreement, little things like that can often get brought up. And so removing those points of friction definitely help in the long run and help the stability of a relationship.
Yeah, it's one of those things where the small things add up, and that's both ways, right? In my current relationship, when we started dating, my girlfriend remarked that I was constantly saying thank you for a lot of things. And she's like, why are you saying thank you? I said, like, because thank you doesn't cost a lot. So, but it means that I pay attention and I care. And that's one of those small things where, why wouldn't I say thank you? Like, you know, I get down I get down from the stairs. I wake up early and the dishwasher has been switched on and has run. And those things, when it happens, I say thank you. Thank you for cleaning up something that was standing on the desk. Thank you for putting the things back on the coat. And it sounds so trivial, but at the same time, like, what's the cost to me? It's just like, hey, I noticed that you cleaned up something like that. I'm glad you do, because I'm glad I'm living with an adult that actually cleans up a few things. And that works both ways. And those thank yous add up over time to a better relationship. So, like, you know, investment's nearly zero and payback is a happy relationship, which is invaluable. So,
right. Has a compound effect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that applies to life as a whole, is really comes down to not taking things for granted and constantly acknowledging what is good. Definitely has a positive effect on everything.
It's definitely one of the things that in my current relationship helps me a lot, because I've definitely made the mistakes where I took things for granted. And these days I never take things for granted. When things are going well, I am amazed every day, and I rather be amazed every day and not forget that things aren't always going to be perfect, and enjoy those moments than just get into like a work rut and circle around it and suddenly wonder why, you know, what happened to the time.
Absolutely. You know, I find it really important to, it sounds super cliche, but to enjoy the moment, because I see it in relationships and just people in their life in general, that they're generally trying to achieve a goal. You know, there's the grass is always greener kind of a mentality. Yeah. And I mean, getting into that mentality with the relationship is just almost the complete opposite of what a relationship is. Interestingly, there's no end goal to a relationship.
No, there's not. Like the grass should be, well, the grass might seem greener somewhere else, but the grass is greener where you are right now, right? It's like the being in a relationship with someone where you respect each other and stuff like that. There's like few basic things that you would like, you know, where you're like on the same level and you can converse and talk about things, and everything else is just pure like winnings on my end. And I appreciate those things on a daily basis, because appreciation on being in a life, appreciating what you have, is like the first start. It's one of the reasons, like, I'm from Europe and I shouldn't be celebrating Thanksgiving, but I celebrate Canadian Thanksgiving because I love the fact that there's food and we give thanks and we thank for something that we enjoyed.
That's interesting. You celebrate Canadian Thanksgiving. There a reason for Canadian and not like American Thanksgiving? Because, I mean, they're both essentially just food and giving thanks at the end of the day.
This is true. Like,
just seems like kind of a weird one to pick.
I'm biased because I worked for Kobo, and Kobo is situated in Toronto, so I know a lot of people in Toronto. So I basically picked Canadian Thanksgiving because I know a lot of Canadians.
Yeah, there had to be some kind of influence.
Some
there.
Reason why it's the Canadian Thanksgiving. Yeah. Of course, obviously, I don't care which Thanksgiving because of the main gist. But I like the fact that there's a lot of friends that celebrate it around the same time. So I still get the benefit of having like friends celebrating the same thing. But I also get the benefit of just being able to go for shopping, because nobody else celebrates Thanksgiving in the Netherlands. So, you know, I can just decide to get stuff one day ahead of time and it's all there.
Yeah. Me and my girlfriend have actually been going through it with Thanksgiving plans and just not doing traditional meals because it's just such chaos and just not worth the trouble. Also, prices are insane for turkeys and things right now. So is turkey the traditional food for Canadian Thanksgiving?
I believe so, like from what I could find, but my partners were vegan. So we had broccoli, I think, and other vegetables that were made with gravy instead of turkey. Also, turkey is a bit much when there's only like a couple of meat eaters on the table. So we usually just made chicken, which was fine as well.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of turkey, or not a huge fan of meat in general, actually. But
same here. So we just balance it up a bit.
Yeah.
And another big benefit that I have for celebrating Thanksgiving in the Netherlands is that I'll never have to contest with other parents for my son's time. You know, I was like, you know, they're not going to be celebrating Thanksgiving. So like when Thanksgiving comes around and you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, I don't care, is like, bring him over, because Thanksgiving there will be food and you'll have time.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't care about Christmas.
It's definitely a thing I've dealt with my whole life. My parents have been separated since I was like 3 months old. So I've always had two households. Luckily, they've been very, very good. I've actually never seen them fight or have disagreements, but it's always a juggle to figure out holiday plans.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Like my ex-partner had separated parents and I had separated parents. So we had like four households that wanted us on Christmas.
Yeah.
That's like, I just at some point said like, no, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not going to spend like 3 days disc jockeying calendars, trying to be everywhere.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't care about the date. You just want family time together. We can do that whole year round, right? Like there's no law that says that I have to be there on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons why the whole I'll celebrate Thanksgiving then was born on my end.
Yeah. I mean, I'm facing that this year. I got three Thanksgivings to attend. Yeah.
So that's like hectic. That kind of takes the fun out of the holidays if you have to like start managing those kind of calendar times.
Yeah. I do wonder, I mean, if it comes from my kind of general lack of sentimentality, but I've never found holidays like significant personally. It's always just seemed kind of forced.
It is forced. It is like, I mean, the benefits to me, because I really looked at it from an engineering standpoint, right? It was like, why would I like to celebrate holidays? And it was like, I would like to be able to have my family together at least once a year. And then I was like, but that's the only thing that I want. I want people to sit together on the table. So why do that at the time of year that everybody wants that? So the traffic's going to be hectic and the food's going to be expensive and you can't get anything because everybody's rushing to get the last morsel of, I don't know, gravy from the shops. I can do that at any time. I also can pick like warmer weather for it. I could do it in the summer. Right. And using that as a base, I said like, okay, let's mix this up. And then we picked Thanksgiving. And I think Canadian Thanksgiving is earlier than American Thanksgiving. So like when we're celebrating Thanksgiving here, it's not really cold yet, meaning that we can like go out for a walk. And the other thing, that's what my dad did at some point, is their family has like a family day now. And that's like end of summer holiday. So it's like still sunny out there. Everybody gets together. We all sing, have some food. I see the whole part of that family in one day and I'm done for that side of the family. I like, everybody has seen me. Excellent.
Right.
I don't have to go to like 16 parties.
Yeah. It's interesting. It seems like a relic of old tradition, just family focus in this obligation to family to do certain things and be certain ways. And I very much love my family. I've got a great family and I'm quite appreciative of them, but it is just strange that there's this overarching obligation and social construct into family. And it makes sense from a historical perspective, you know, communities survive, but I've always felt friction in regard to it and what is expected of me as a member of a blood family, you know? Because I've been part of other families where there's not an obligation, but I feel more involved and more connected. But it's just an interesting thing that it's such a common perspective that family matters no matter what, you know?
Yeah.
Because I know plenty of people with really crap families, really bad, toxic, not good families who still participate in that community just out of some sense of obligation to. And yeah, I don't quite agree with it.
No, and I agree with you as well. Like your chosen family is usually the better option. And it's like, yeah, I've seen it. The families that don't get along. I have parts of my family that I just don't vibe with the way that I can relate to other family parts that I have. And in the end, of course, being together is fun, but it depends a bit like, okay, you get to pick who you're together with. And if bloodline is the only reason and you're just sitting across the table going like, yeah, what should we talk about now? Reevaluating that is definitely something that changes. I'm also super curious how the future changes with all the new technology around, right? Because my dad, he couldn't video call me to save his life. I mean, we tried once and he was making noise and I switched him on mute and he needed like 5 minutes to find the unmute button. And then I look at my son and me and we're just both on Discord playing video games together in the same house because it's like easier to switch on Discord than shout through the hallway. So I'm always going like, okay, won't I have the same problem as my parents did? Because I'll be able to just send them a message going like, hey, do you got time like for an hour of Minecraft or something else? And we both can just chill online and I can ask anything about how he's doing, like doing the basic parenting stuff while we're playing a video game. So none of us are bored.
Yeah, I mean, and I do wonder how much of that is also just a drive to relate to some degree or to stay relevant to them. Because a lot of parents seem to not try to relate or not really try to understand their culture and their lifetime that they live in, their generation they live in. And they make like assumptions and stuff, but yeah, don't seem to actually put in the effort to really understand and really relate to them. And so I mean, I think, you know, if someone really wanted to, even an older person could probably figure out like how to use that stuff if they were trying to relate more.
Yeah, I think it's always the gap is smaller between me and my son than me and my mother, for example, even though the age difference is similar. I mean, our discussions are usually about me using old school memes and him using like modern memes, which is just like the fact that there's like two generation of memers in one household is just mind-blowing to me.
Yeah,
like he goes like, you don't know anything about modern memes, and I'll just be going like, you know don't cite the old rituals to me, which I was there when it was written.
Yeah,
and then he goes like, that's so old school. So yes, but it's from my generation, so I get to use those memes non-ironically.
Yeah, I mean, it's silly coming up on 30 years old. Over the past few years, I've definitely started feeling the getting older aspect and relating to younger people. Like TikTok is not good to me. I do not really enjoy what is happening there, but it's very much like the culture of like the youth culture online at the moment. But I also don't have many people part of that culture to relate to in my life, so it's not a huge deal. And maybe if I did, I'd try a little more to understand what's good about it, because I'm sure it's not bad when you are in full understanding of what it is, you know, but it is interesting getting older and that feeling of being in touch with the younger generation, how they think and what they do, kind of slipping away a little bit, even though in my mind, I'm still very young.
Well, that's the weird thing. I talked to my grandma about this at some point, and she told me that while your body grows older, your brain does not. It gets out of touch maybe a bit because you need to keep up with like the younger generation, but you have like a choice in how much you want to keep up with that and how much you want to adjust to it. And that makes an interesting conversation that I had with her about it as well, because her generation grew up in a world where you had to physically be. So your body getting older and frailer means you can't do everything anymore, even though my grandma's amazing and she's still line dancing at 88 years old. But I'm part of like, and you're part of it as well, from like the first generation that has like such a large part of our lives are online, where it's just our brains, right? The rest is just who you are online. I mean, you can take any picture and put it in front of your face, and the rest is just what you type from your brain. Meaning that if what my grandma says is right and my brain doesn't age, it will, of course, but that means that I can like that age becomes like a non-existing thing on the internet, which is definitely something that I've noticed sometimes, because you can't really gauge someone's age when you're conversing with them online.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of times I've been talking with someone on Reddit or something like that only to find out they're 60 years old. It's like, oh, wow, I had no idea. But I do wonder if there's going to be emerging technologies that do kind of replace that. I think a lot of people near our age and generation might actually have trouble with like virtual reality, which is very clearly going to become more and more of a thing. So I do wonder if they'll just kind of be the the new computer, as computers are to older generations, something like that to us.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing, like as someone with a lot of virtual reality in the house and seeing a lot of people going through it, and some people just taking like a duck to water and other people just not being able to do anything with it. I'm not sure if it's a generation thing or an individual thing.
Yeah, VR to some extent is meant to emulate real life more than a computer is. You know, a computer is more of this external thing you're interfacing with, while VR is much more of a trying to replicate real life to some degree. So it is interesting that some people just have trouble with that.
Yeah, that's like definitely, because yesterday I spent like 3 hours in VR playing a Groundhog Day, like Father, Like Son. And the line between reality is blurry at some point, because I don't think about how I need to control, like what button do I need to press? No, I had to, I think at some point, scope something. And there's just tools lying there. There was like a grinder and a drill and a hammer. And I don't think about the buttons that I need to push, right? I just grab one of those tools from the rack and I just start hammering at the stone. So there's like no interface anymore. I mean, yeah, there is an interface because I'm pushing buttons and moving stuff through space, but it doesn't feel like an interface. It doesn't act like an interface. I just grab the tool and I use it. And it's so weird.
Yeah, it's kind of the four levels of competence. You know, when you have unconscious competence with something, it becomes integrated as part of you. The first time I actually experienced that is I learned to juggle when I was like 17 or so. And I don't mean just like three ball cascade, but I got like really into juggling and all the stuff with it. But juggling became a point where I could do it without thinking at all. There's zero thought process in it. I just kind of flipped on a switch and my body would start juggling. And that just comes down to competence and experience. And so I think a lot of it does have to do with the amount of time you take to try to be competent at these kind of things.
Yeah, I think that's like the main thing, right? Where you're like doing something for such a period of time that you don't think about it because it's like programmed into your brain.
Yeah. And it's an argument for always learning, you know, and never stop learning, which is not something that's very ingrained in society today. People finish school and just call it quits on learning a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Because, I really wish education pushed a stronger degree of passion for learning or trying to make learning more fun, because you go through schooling these days and learning is not taught in a fun way and it puts a bad taste in your mouth for it. And then people think of learning as work, you know, or they think of it as a chore.
Yeah, I remember that one, trying to explain it to my son.
We didn't have a very graceful ending for this episode, but we hope you enjoyed and we'll see you in the next one.